Throughout the year, we drink NC wine, cider, and mead. Whether you join us for an event, plan a visit to your local winery, cidery, or meadery, or enjoy a meal at your favorite restaurant perfectly paired with NC wine, anytime is a great time to get out and give love to your local maker. To plan your trip, download the NC Wine app or visit ncwine.org.
And I'm Joe. We're the NC Wine Guys. Welcome to Season 5 of Cork Talk.
In this episode, we sit down with Matt and Katie, the winemakers at Dynamis Estate Wines in Jonesville, North Carolina.
Matt and Katie talk to us about what it takes to create a premium wine brand in North Carolina and how they're working hard to create a top quality product.
We're happy to announce that Wine Class of the Wine Mouths is back for Season 5. Stick around to hear about the theme for this season. This episode is made possible by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. You can learn more about the council by going to their website, ncwine.org.
So sit back, pour a glass, and listen.
All right, so we're here today with Matt and Katie from Dynamis Estate Wines. Matt and Katie, welcome to Cork Talk.
We're glad to be here.
Yes.
Super excited. Thanks for having us.
So why don't you two introduce yourselves and tell folks who you are and what you do at Dynamis?
Sure. I guess I can start. So I'm Matt Worrell. I'm one of the winemakers, one of the partners. Katie and I have kind of founded this company, but we don't like attach it too much to our titles. But yeah, Matt Worrell winemaker.
My name's Katie Kidd. Yes, I'm the other winemaker slash one of the partners and owners here, and kind of share a lot of different hats within the company.
Yeah. As you often do when you work at, you know, North Carolina Winery and
Vineyard. Right, yeah.
Yes.
So tell us how Dynamis got started.
Yeah, so going back in time to 2019, which doesn't feel like it was that long ago.
But yet at the same time, an eternity ago.
Right? Yeah, I know. It's been a lot's changed since then. But it just kind of happened that Katie and I have been working together now for almost going on our seventh season, so we've known each other pretty well, and you kind of like find a dynamic with people, and once you kind of click with somebody, you want to continue to work with them. And I mean, I think it comes to a point in everybody's career where they want to start their own brand, just like a chef might want his own restaurant. Winemakers do, I think, want their own winery. At least I know I did, and Katie did. And working with this property, so Katie's known about it probably longer.
Yeah, so we're familiar with the property, and it's really quite extraordinary. But at the time, it was a vineyard planted just selling grapes to other wineries in the area. At the time, there was no winery on site. The plan was just to sell all the grapes grown from the property. But we had an opportunity to pitch a business plan to the owner of the property of why we felt like we could really have a premium brand and a winery on site.
Yeah, it was, well, we were looking in North Carolina from a point of growth, and we know that the way we set the brand up wouldn't have worked 10 years ago, for example. So we kind of saw first the great vineyard site with great fruit, incredible chemistry, and we kind of saw that as an opportunity. If somebody's going to move into that market that doesn't really produce, it's not saying that North Carolina doesn't make premium wines, because they do. There's plenty of great producers out there, but they were kind of paving that way for somebody like us to step in. So as everybody else has been growing, we kind of just kind of took a leap off that and creating our own kind of spin on the business. We've always been fans of like Opus One, Record of Ink, and Trailblazers in their industries, and how they kind of changed the perception of like East Coast wine. Not just one, obviously, but I think people have looked at them on the East Coast saying, hey, let's try to model like, you know, reservation only, smaller production, really high quality, and make a few wines. That's the other kind of the keys. Like, we want to, you know, they make two, we make five currently, but that's still, in retrospect, a small list in comparison to a lot of people. It's really trying to do something well.
It's kind of like a restaurant, right?
So you don't want to see the big
massive menu.
Yeah.
Like, do you do anything really well, or do you want to focus in on what you want to do the best?
Right. We never want to spread ourselves too thin. We wanted to focus on, like you said, like what we do well and really achieve at that. And our focus from the very beginning was that really making the best wine, essentially a winemaker-driven winery and concept that way.
Yeah, which is, you'll see it where, like, people have their careers, like, either out west or anything. You see, like, oh, this winemaker gets a little traction, notoriety, and you'll see them split off from whatever winery they're working for and start their own company shortly after. You usually have a lot of success. Same with restaurants. Chef and restaurants are awesome because they really care about what they're doing. There's no, you know, quotas. Like, it's less of a, oh, we have to hit all these deadlines. It's we're going to make the best product, period. And present that to you. And it was also just, again, of like, we both grew up in North Carolina. So we wanted to stay in North Carolina. And we liked dry red wines, dry white wines. We wanted to be taken very seriously. And you kind of have to create your own mold for that. And there's just limited opportunities for like really big jobs for that in North Carolina. Because people that are already in their positions, that stay there, are staying there for a reason. So this was our like one shot to make it work for us in North Carolina. So whereas, you know, we talked about, well, I guess we'll have to, you know, move to California or not move to Europe or anything. And it's like, we don't want to give up. So this was like that one time to do it. And we took that idea and ran with it.
So you mentioned that the vineyard was planted before you all got started. So what was planted originally, and have there been any changes since?
Yes. Yeah, so I know the first half of it was planted in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And we're mainly looking at Bordeaux red wines here. Started with a lot of Cabernet Sauvignon, a lot of Petit Verdot. Then there were some grapes that were planted to kind of fit the needs of the area. Like people wanted Traminette. So Traminette is on our site currently. That is changing. And then Pinot Gris. So there's a lot of Traminette, Pinot Gris. And then you had Cab Sauv, Petit Verdot, and Merlot. So we had three out of the five, and then the following season, like 2016 and some in 2017, we started adding, we're not even there yet, Sauvignon Blanc, so that's your Bordeaux white. Chardonnay was planted, I'm not sure exactly why, but it's there.
Because everyone plants Chardonnay.
That's it, exactly. Someone's going to have some Chardonnay somewhere. And then they also added Malbec and Cabernet Franc. So we eventually accumulated all five red Bordeaux grapes. We have our Sauvignon Blanc. The future, like I was talking about Traminette earlier, so we are going to pull up some of those plantings to put in more Cab Franc, more Merlot, and probably more Cab Sauv in the future too. And really focusing on those.
Okay, you mentioned it was kind of a unique property itself. So we've been there; it's awesome. Walk the listener through what it's like getting to there.
So it's about a 2.5 mile drive up to the tasting lodge, where you actually have the wine tasting experience. So as Matt was talking about the vineyard site, the first vines that you actually see are actually some of our newer plantings. You drive up and you first see, it's kind of, to me, I've always felt like it's like driving into a national forest. Yes. Or a state park, as you're surrounded by trees. And then you drive up and you see some of our newer plantings of Cabernet Sauvignon, and you see some Petit Verdot and some Malbec on the right side. You continue to drive up and you see some of our white plantings of Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc. And then once you get closer to the tasting lodge, actually as you're looking out from the tasting lodge, you'll look out to our older vines, where our Cabernet Sauvignon is, and our Merlot is, and our Petit Verdot is.
I noticed one of the key things you kept on saying in there is, and you keep driving up.
Yes.
And you keep driving up.
Yeah, it's almost 1,000-foot elevation change, like from the gate all the way up. And I mean, it could come to the point of, like, for example, it'll be snowing at the top of the mountain. And as I was like driving down and checked the mountain one time, that snow turned to rain. And that's just how drastic the difference is of just a few miles.
Yeah, it can be as much as about a 10-degree temperature shift just from the top of the mountain to the bottom.
So what kind of benefits does that give you from like a grape growing perspective?
Well, we can split this up. I'll take some of them and you take half.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so really looking at, so elevation as a concept is, one, it's airflow. So frost is a big issue in North Carolina. That's like one of the big things. And for that elevation, you know, people always think, well, you know, higher elevation should be colder temperatures, and maybe you're at a higher risk, and that's not really the case. I mean, once you get up to like maybe 5,000 and going towards like Banner and Elk and Boone, you're not growing a lot of grapes up there. But we actually get that shift of, you know, cold air is denser than warm air, so it's rolling down the hills. And as long as your vines are on that slope, you're avoiding that long contact time with, you know, cold temperatures that are actually going to cause damage. Not saying we're immune to it. Like, we will still get, you know, frosted, but not to the point that we're worried about it. We're talking, you know, 5% max. And this kind of like roots back to the history of their orchards, almost, you know, for a century planted out. They still are. And also Joseph Geller, he's our orchard manager, he'd be really upset. But I didn't mention that too, because he has a lot of pride in those trees. But it has always been a proven site for growing small fruit. And that's a good indicator versus, like, you know, a lot of people work tobacco farms or cow pastures or anything like that. And stemming from, we've always grown tiny fruit, we're still growing tiny fruit. This is grapes.
Smaller.
Well, way more grapes than apples. We do still have the apples. But yeah, so elevation to the frost protection, to the same thing with the slopes. So
that kind of like transitions to rainfall events.
We get a lot of rain here.
Yes. And somewhat similar to Bordeaux, actually, they get a decent amount of rain, but they have very well-drained sites. Even looking at rainfall that we do have, you can really see, like, even a couple hours after rain, and really from the slope that we have and the soil that we have, we don't have quite as much clay. We have a lot more rocky soil. So it doesn't really retain a lot of that moisture.
Yeah, so you're getting rid of moisture quickly. That's kind of like the challenge there is, as rain falls, it clays a little bit of a sponge. So it's going to stick around. And as the sun comes up and heats up, you're going to boost your humidity in your vineyard. That's where water is getting out very quickly. And there's also the breeze.
So the constant movement of the air.
Air circulation. So it's a combination of air circulation, getting water out, wicking moisture out with a breeze. And then I think it's the highest elevation in the Aggie. I think there's a plaque somewhere.
Sure seems like it.
Yeah. So being like at that elevation, like I was saying, dark. I guess from a winemaking standpoint, that's allowing us to ripen these varietals with less disease pressure. Of course, we still have disease pressure like everybody else, but we can kind of hang it out there a little bit longer. Pushing a lot of our harvests closer to November. A lot of times it's like, you know, it's the last weeks of October that we're kind of finishing up, like Cabernet Sauvignon. These are varietals that if you want to make a true to form, if not, make a rosé, and that's always good too. And that's what we started doing with Malbec. So, like, you know, Malbec for us was like, it made an okay red wine, and we've used it in blends, but it's never been to the point of like, oh, let's plant some more Malbec because it's so stellar. it's okay for a red grape, but for a rosé, it's awesome. High yields, and if you're going to like crop anything up, rosé is the time to do that. Pick it early, make some really nice and fresh. Don't bank on it every year to be like that one component to your blend that you need, because we don't
have to. So you wouldn't recommend a whole vineyard cider just?
No. Well,
not on the East Coast from what we've tried.
Yeah, I know some people really do, you know, give it a good shot, like King Family in Virginia, for example. Mm-hmm. They make a single bottle all day. I don't think every year.
Yeah, they do kind of like, they have like a small batch series that they do with it.
Yeah. It's limited here in North Carolina too. There's very few people who do just a single bottle.
Right, and I think a lot of times it's a blending grape, but they're really large berries. So like they're full of water, and you know, that's fine for rosé.
So you mentioned that previously there was an orchard there. So let's spend some time talking about the orchard history.
Yeah. So Joseph's the guy, but I think a little bit. I think it was 1915.
I believe so.
Essentially,
yes.
Like I think locals will say that there's evidence of it dating back further than 1915, but it was apple orchards. I think they had tomatoes up there, so we're still talking about small fruit on vines.
Yeah.
But at one point it was. Was it 100 acres of apples? Is that crazy? It was a large planting. I didn't know that. But because, like, for example, today, I think fruit trees take up like 10 acres of totality. It's a 1,500 acre property, I guess, also to put that into perspective.
But the tasting lodge where we do our tasting experiences is where the apple house was.
Yeah, and it was, I guess, yeah, apple storage, and then it was also housing for workers. And this is like the 1940s, 1950s. And I do know it was owned by the Click family. And I know that family is still in the area. And I think she grew up on the mountain. That was the thing. She was like, my house used to be like right here where these cherries are planted.
Oh, that's
like,
awesome.
That's where she's like turning 90.
She came to see us.
And she's having her birthday up there soon. And I think she's turning like 96 or something. But this is really cool to hear just like somebody that was connected with that property. And, you know, she could definitely tell you all those details about what really happened up there. But it was, it was an orchard for so long. And at some point, was unfarmed for like 40 years.
Right. Like, so a lot of the trees they weren't producing any longer once the property owner purchased the property. But he really kind of wanted to keep up that orchard theme of just the history of it. So we do still have some apples planted, some peaches planted, some other fruit trees.
Pears and cherries.
Which currently we're not doing really anything with that. But we've been selling to some cideries in the area. And then we're actually looking at doing a small amount of palmetto.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so a lot of people aren't really familiar with you guys.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so palmetto is big in Normandy. It's a French beverage that you'll see some in New York and Washington State and Oregon. But it's not like super prevalent. But essentially, you're taking apple juice and then you're taking apple brandy and you're fortifying just the juice itself up to around like 20-22% alcohol. And so the only used barrels that we buy are Salterne's barrels. So we've got two of them just for that project. So we're putting them in Salterne's barrels for at least 2 to 4 years. So this year is going to be experimental for it. Like, we actually had some brandy made and we actually have the juice, you know, stored and ready to go. So we're probably going to actually, we might do that this week. And just kind of see what like people's reception is, because it's a nice little aperitif.
Right.
You know, with cheese and with it being fortified the juice, it still kind of has this like really natural apple element to it. And I think the Salterne's barrels are just going to kind of, I don't know, you know, you might get some tropical management or something like that. I'm not an expert on it. Like I said, we were completely experimenting here.
Yeah.
But we're going to see how that goes. Thing versus like a cider. Like, a cider doesn't really fit our brand. Like, we like cider, we'll drink it. But as far as the luxury wine and, you know, aesthetic, it's, you know, if you can also buy pints of cider, it's a little like, where are you going to put your energy? Like, you know, you want people up here to actually enjoy the wines versus that. But I think palmetto is like the best fit for if you're going to do something with apples, do something really interesting and elegant.
Yeah, unique. You don't really think of it.
Right. And that also might bring another idea to other people of orchards that maybe they want to make something more premium than just we'll see how it goes and don't judge us if it's terrible. If it's terrible, we're not going to sell it. But
yes.
I'm sure it'll be great. Yeah. So that's exciting. So you've talked a little bit, Katie has referenced a few times, tasting experience. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about what the tasting experience is like. What's kind of what some of the offerings are?
Sure. So once you come to see us, we have a couple of different options for you. We can do a self-guided experience where essentially is kind of like a flight experience. It's really more for those that want to taste wine and just, I would say, enjoy your company.
But relax and take everything in, right?
Yes.
It's just more of amongst your own friends, or if you know you bring your significant other up there, maybe you just want to talk to them and not listen to us the entire time. Because originally there was only going to be one option, which was you're getting a seated, guided experience. That's it. But then I think it was actually Jenny was doing some research on it and talking to some wineries in the area, and they were saying that like, you know, sometimes people just want to be with themselves and kind of explore that on their own.
That's a great thing to do, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're like, okay, we'll have an option. I prefer people to do the guided option because it's kind of a new idea. It's a very high price point wine and a lot of that. But once they kind of sit down and actually get the story, and if you have an attendant there that's knowledgeable and they can answer all of your questions accurately, it sells itself.
Our other experience has been, it's all a seated experience, really, to relax and unwind and take your time with each wine. And we'll take you through, currently we have one white wine, our Sauvignon Blanc. We also have a Merlot, our Cabernet Sauvignon, and two different blends that we offer. So we talk to our guests about each wine and pretty much fill them in as much information as they want to know. And in addition to that, we offer different cheese plates and grazing boxes, kind of charcuterie spreads, that sort of thing, in addition to our tasting.
Yeah, and that's also locally sourced and kind of going into, we wanted to do the commercial kitchen thing, and I think there's still plans for that. But as far as, I mean, it's like, it's a 100-year-old building, and like retrospecting that out to fit all the check marks for a commercial kitchen seems to be like a little bit more of a headache than we want to deal with at the moment. So we source it from Bark and Coyote, which is an Elkin, awesome place. They really care. They have a farm. Like, a lot of the produce they have is sourced from their farm, and actually a lot of, like, again, where do the apples go? Where the peaches? We'll send it to them to make like chutneys and little accoutrements for the boards. So we kind of keep it as local as possible. So it's like a little hybridization of, yeah, some of it's ours and they prepare it, but it's still, you know, you can drive 10 minutes on the road and find where it came from. So it's not just like prepackaged, whatever you might find at the grocery store. Of course, it's better to have that than nothing, but but we wanted to add like a personal.
So we're actually in a really good spot to take a quick little break, but when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the winemaking approach that y'all have. And then maybe let's talk a little bit about the wines themselves.
All right, sounds good.
Sounds great.
It's time again for Wine Class with the Wine Mouths. Jesse, Jessica, welcome back to season 5.
Thanks.
Thanks so much. I can't believe it's been 5 seasons.
Who knew? And it's already January too, so it's incredibly, it's like a double whammy.
So, new year. New topic for the year. So what are we going to be exploring this year?
This year we're going to go into history.
Ooh, we like history.
Yeah. We are just going to do the history of wine across the year. So we are going to divide the year up into 12 parts and historical periods. And we hope you join us through the year and go with us through the history of wine.
Exciting.
Well, we'll be here, so.
Yeah. So yeah, we're going to talk about what's happening, and we'll try to tie it to modern day winemaking and modern day things going on, and we'll end each segment with some fun wine pairings.
We do like a good wine pairing too, so that's exciting. And it sounds like we have a lot of ground to cover, so where are we going to start?
We have our work cut out for us. Buckle up. There will be a test at the end.
So for January, we are going to cover the BC times. So we're just going to get us to zero, right? We're going to do all the BC times.
Okay. Well, let's get going.
So before we get started, one thing we wanted to kind of delve into or explain for those who don't know is the idea of old world versus new world. We'll probably drop that around a lot, but in general, wine countries are usually determined as old world or new world. So obviously, old world comes first, and that's where we'll be for a little while, for a few months. These are some of the first wine producing regions. And then later on, we'll get into the new world. But so, you know, France, Italy, Spain, that type of thing you think of, that's going to be old world. And new world's going to be the United States, South Africa, South America, Australia, New Zealand. But just keep that in mind, because that'll kind of, we'll probably use the term old world a lot.
Very cool.
So the story of wine begins, like most things in the old world, also with most things, the expansion of wine is going to track the empires and religion thanks to trade and demands and skills. So wine, you know, tracks through the history of the world, as most things do, with the rise and fall of different empires. But to start, our Vitis vinifera grapes, the ones we love so much, are native to the region of modern-day Georgia, that kind of modern-day area of Armenia, Georgia, parts of Iran, Russia, and Turkey. So that is where we are starting off on our journey.
Exciting. Kind of a nice place to kick things off.
Yep. And, you know, something to keep in mind is the first wines were accidents. Everything you need to make wine is naturally present on a grape. So if you have grapes in the field or and they're growing naturally and you pick them and just let them sit, they're going to turn into some form of alcohol. They're going to ferment.
It makes things a little bit easier, I guess.
Yeah. Right. It's just when you harness that power is when stuff gets exciting. Yeah. So we'll continue our story, or I guess I suppose start it really in China and the Middle East. So the weird thing about BC times is they go backwards. So somewhere between 7,000 and 6,600 BC, we're not going to get too hung up in the dates here, but there is evidence from ancient tribes in the Yellow River Valley of China, evidence of a fermented rice, honey, fruit wine that was stored in earthenware jars. So this goes way back. Kind of coming next after that, you know, so we have civilization itself beginning in the Middle East. So it kind of naturally follows that wine is such a civilized thing, right? Also originated in the same region. Archaeologists have discovered the oldest winemaking facility in Armenia, so back in that Middle Eastern region, along with grape residue in clay jars in Georgia and signs of grape domestication in eastern Turkey, all the way back to 8,000 and 4,000 BC. The Russian winemaking pots called kuvri, and it's spelled really fun, it's Q-V-E-V-R-I. And these have been traced back to what's modern day Georgia, which all of this area is in the news a lot right now, of course. And there's ancient winemaking pots that date back to China and all over this area. So really just kind of pervasive. There's even been evidence of grape growing and wine consumption from the late Stone Age that's been discovered all the way up in northern Italy near Venice. So really just quite pervasive. So the interesting thing about these winemaking pots that I struggled over the pronunciation and spelling of, the kuvri, is that today in Georgia, they still are practicing making wine in earthenware vessels, the same ones. And also the cement eggs that we see sometimes even now harken back to this method or mode as well. Hmm. So still being done. What's old is new again.
Exactly. It's interesting to see how these trends kind of come and go.
Mm-hmm. Even more in this area, wine has been produced in Israel since biblical times. It was exported to Rome during the Roman period, you know, so all over in this whole area of Mesopotamian Egypt, and with trade and winemaking knowledge and influences and the rise and fall of civilizations in this area, it really just played a big important role in these early times.
Okay, well, tell us more.
All right. So in addition to the kuvri, we also see evidence of clay pots called amphorae. And so we'll see these throughout ancient Greek and Roman history. So the Vitis vinifera grape, which was indigenous to what's modern day Georgia, right? So these really grew and expanded and were cultivated throughout Europe then at this point. And we have a lot of this to thank the ancient Greeks and Romans. So we see this in the archaeological history with these clay pots, the amphorae, just the spread of production and use of wine throughout the world. and so by 3000 BC, winemaking had begun in the Middle East and spread and was definitely established throughout Europe by then, by this 3000 BC time period. So like I mentioned, we have the Greeks to thank for a lot of this, kind of setting the stage. And so to kind of paint a picture, at its cultural and geographical peak, Greek civilization spread all the way from Egypt to the mountains in Afghanistan. So they were really, you know, pervasive and prevalent in this area. Moving forward a little bit, Greece eventually gets conquered by the Roman Republic in the 2nd century BC. So there's some overlap in ancient Greek and ancient Roman civilizations. And so we see some overlapping influences here. They were distinct, but they also overlapped. So that's, can you hold that in the back of your mind? But in the ancient world, Greece was once one of the foremost producers of wine. But if we think about that modern connection, today, Greek wines are really only recently starting to be drunk throughout the rest of the world. It's kind of a newer thing back on the global stage. But back in the ancient world, it was one of the biggest producers of wine. So the earliest evidence of Greek wine is really dated to 6,500 years ago. And at this point, it was produced on a household or communal basis. In ancient times, so trade starts to become more extensive, and it's transported from the end to end of the Mediterranean by the Greeks. And like I said, Greeks and Romans overlap some. And so Greek wine had an especially high prestige in Italy under the Roman Empire. So that's kind of interesting.
It sounds fun. I mean, it's hard to find it nowadays. Mm-hmm. So I guess it seems like it was everywhere back then.
Yeah, and of high importance. So by 2000 BC, wine was a really important part of Greek culture. And the expansion of the Greek Empire brought vineyards and winemaking and knowledge and skills throughout the Mediterranean and the Greek Empire. So again, stretching from North Africa to southern Spain, southwestern France, Sicily, the Italian mainland, so really just all throughout. And so I mentioned those amphorae. So these are those clay Greek pots. They would have been sealed with pine resin and tops were attached. So we see, you know, evidence of these throughout the archaeological record. And then I also mentioned how there's some overlap, right, between the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire. And so you'll see that just in the name of their gods. So Dionysus, the Greek god of wine, is similar to Bacchus, the Roman god of wine. So there's that overlap, distinct but similar.
And so moving into Roman history a little bit, it's very similar to the Greek history. They overlap. You know, at its peak, the Roman Empire stretched more across the Mediterranean. So what we think of today is Portugal, Spain, England, Western Europe, and then part of Northern Africa too, and some of Western Asia. But we see it more along the Mediterranean. And so grapes have been growing. We have, you know, winemaking going on, but the Romans took it to the next level. So, you know, we have grapes, we have wine, but Romans were really the ones that brought about some of our technological advances in viticulture and winemaking that set the stage for where we are today. So a few of those things, Romans were coopers. And so they were the first to use oak barrels for fermentation, storage, and transport of wine. So that's a big one because we still do that today. But we start to see that with the Roman Empire and with the Romans.
They probably weren't using American oak back then.
No. That would have been a little hard to get.
And so the Roman Empire is expanding, and they're expanding, you know, into some of the areas we consider today. And they're starting to grow grape vines in France, and some of the regions we think of today are starting to get established under the Roman Empire as winemaking regions, such as Languedoc, the Rhone Valley, Burgundy, Bordeaux. So these areas are starting to become, you know, what they are today.
Fascinating.
Something interesting with the Roman Empire. So it expanded, it started to drive demand and trade for wine. So, you know, under the Greek Empire, we kind of see a lot of wine being made, but it was more under the household level or community level. The Roman Empire and the Romans started actually taking the wine and making trade and using it as an economic advantage for what they were doing. But when we think about the wine from the Roman Empire, don't think of it as the wine we're drinking today, because it wasn't. It was very different. They often mixed water with it to decrease the high alcohol content because it was drank more regularly. And the palate often liked sweeter wine. And so they drank sweet wines. I mean, if we think about our general progression of taste and how most folks start with sweet wine, we're still very early on. So the Roman Empire started off with sweet wine as well. And they even mixed their wine. They mixed honey. They added herbs and spices, salt. So the wine was not what we think of as wine today.
I'm looking at anything goes mix.
Yes. But, you know, going back to some of the improvements the Roman Empire brought to winemaking, they introduced the use of trellises. So if we think about grapevines, they don't grow, you know, up in pretty rows and with their branches out perfectly for the clusters. So the introduction of trellises to support grape growing came from the Romans. they improved the presses and some of the different implements they were using to make wines as well. We see a lot. We can thank the Romans for a lot of things that have helped us on our wine journey. It's also believed that the Romans were the first to use glass jars as well and corks, not exactly the same corks we have today, but just the general idea of a glass container that is corked for holding the wine. The Roman Empire is growing. We're getting closer now to our zero, the end of our BC times, but just a couple of fun things with ending out this time period. So we see evidence in 200 BC, some ancient writings or different things where Roman soldiers were encouraged to drink 2 to 3 liters of wine a day for good health.
Wow.
But hopefully that was the watered down version.
They were very well hydrated.
In 121 BC, that year is called the Opimum. Oh my gosh.
Opimum, maybe?
Yes.
I have no idea.
Vintage, okay. But that is the best vintage of the Roman Golden Age. And it was named, the vintage was named after one of the consuls of the time. So that's kind of the first year we see where they've actually, you know, noted a vintage year for the wine.
Interesting. I wonder what they would have called it.
I don't know. I don't even know what the grape variety was either, but something
they probably didn't know.
I was going to say, they may not have either.
Sure. The Greeks and Romans the Greeks got it started and then the Romans really took it to that next level. And like Jesse said, just gave us a lot of the practices we're still using today, but really expanded even all the way up into Germany, you know? So when we learn about different wine regions and how it all connects, it kind of goes back to this, like you're starting at the beginning. And so it's a helpful frame of reference as you learn about different wine regions to know how it got there and why.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we just went 8,000 years in the past 15 minutes. So that's yeah, exactly. That's so much.
I have whiplash a little.
And a fun note to kind of wrap up on too is that Cleopatra's favorite wine was Muscat of Alexandria, and that wine is still made today. Mm. If you ever want to enjoy what Cleopatra's favorite was, there you go.
While taking my bath in milk. But also, like, not to talk politics too much, but yeah, a lot of the wines we drink today are from these areas, but even the birthplace of wine, there would probably be more, except that's a very politically unstable area and like historically has been. Or, you know, one of the points we had up here is that there are 3 languages that had a word for wine that are not derived from Latin. So Greek, Basque, and Hungarian. And so even here, you would probably see more wine from Hungary or that area if it weren't for political instability that's been prevalent, you know, not just in modern history, but throughout. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of interesting that wine was probably made and produced there. It just maybe didn't get out or has not been exported because of trade and civilization and all those overarching themes that we talked about at the beginning.
Very interesting. So now we talked about some pairing ideas too. What would you have with an 8,000 BC wine?
Yeah. So if I happened upon an amphorae of unspoiled Greek wine. Now, I don't know. So the route we took with this is kind of what would have been representative of this time. So there is a Georgian wine. So Georgia, the birthplace of wine, not just a state in the United States. So Georgian wine would be Arcapitelli that we're starting to be a little bit more familiar with because that is grown here in the United States now. And so this is a fun one. I believe we've talked about it before on the podcast. That can be fun to pair with. It's a white wine, a little crisp, a little acidic. So it plays nicely with others. What would you guys pair that with? I'm tossing it to you first.
I think we usually do like a crab cake with our Arcapitelli because that nice fresh acidity goes really well with seafood.
I was going to say seafood.
Yeah.
And how about yourselves?
I think that seafood is a nice choice. For sure, can stand up against that. Like we like to throw out Thai food or sushi. I'm not sure how that would go against these. Might play okay with some of those. I'm trying to picture it. Maybe it could work like a, you know, like a cream cheesy roll. So So another representative of this time period we picked was Muscat of Alexandria. So we were talking about Cleopatra's favorite wine. Does that make her like an original influencer? Like hashtag sponsored Muscat of Alexandria. So this would have been a sweeter wine, which, you know, representative of the taste of the time. And this might go well with like an almond biscotti or charcuterie that's going to have a variety of, you know, salty meats, but also could go with a nice soft pungent cheese and some dried fruits or something like that. Pair nicely with a variety.
I can see that. And sometimes like a slightly sweeter wine goes well with some savory foods too, because like, mm-hmm. just like comfort foods or, you know, just like everyday foods, because it's not something that you have to be special and fancy about, but it just goes well.
Have you guys ever had a Muscat of Alexandria?
I believe we have at some point, but I'm not completely sure about that.
Yeah, same here. I'm like, I don't know that I've had one. Actually, I'm going to have to go search one out now.
Yeah. I know I've had things that have that root in the name, like Muscat or Muscadet or Muscadine, which we know is not related, but, you know, kind of a familiar root word.
The Muscat family is a large family.
Mm-hmm.
Like Muscat Blanc, Muscat Canelli.
And then one more we picked from this, like the very first one I threw out there was a mead. So, you know, a honey wine that would have been found like in ancient China, you know, and also made throughout area as well. So a traditional mead you might pick can play nicely again with a cheese board to run the gamut between those more savory and sweet offerings on that. A fruit mead could be fun with some tacos, like fish tacos with a fruit salsa. A salad with strawberries and other fruit on it, goat cheese, you know, so it could be kind of fun to match against that.
I agree with all of those. I mean, mead just is such a versatile thing. It's like, okay, just play around and experiment.
I just pictured a cheese board that also had like little glasses of different kinds of meads on it as well, part of the cheese board. How fun would that be?
That sounds really fun.
Yeah, the mead category is so massive.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be fun to explore all the different styles and varieties.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, it's been 8,000 years. So any parting words on this history's lesson today?
I think it's time to take a nap. Wow. It's quite a trip.
Yeah, I don't know. We're just setting the stage for the next era in wine history and how it got us to today. So
8,000 down, 2,000 more. So. Yeah. All right. Well, Jesse, Jessica, thank you very much. It's been very enlightening and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you.
You can find out more information about the Wine Mouths by going to their website, winemouths.com, or on Facebook and Instagram at Wine Mouths. That's WineMouths. And now, back to the show.
So we're back with Katie and Matt. So let's talk a little bit more specifically about the wines and the winemaking style. So maybe walk us through kind of the portfolio currently and maybe anything that you want to preview that's coming down the pike.
Yeah, for sure. Do you want me to start?
Go for it.
Okay. So, currently on our wine list, I'm sure we probably mentioned previously, we have 5 wines. And again, going back to almost like the Opus 1 premise and the mindset of, you know, really do make 2 wines. That was our whole idea at first. But then once you make those, you make 2 blends. I'm going in reverse here. I should start. So let's go back. So varietals, so I'm going to block it. I have a white wine. That's one thing we noticed early, especially when we opened up in the summer. It's like no one wants to drink high alcohol red wines in the summertime.
It gets hot here.
It's so hot. Yeah. we have a varietal Merlot, and that's only like these are the really small productions. Like Sauvignon was like 200 cases. Merlot was 200 cases. And we have a varietal Cabernet Sauvignon. It's only 100 cases, like super limited. Then the rest of our production comes from our 2 red blends, which is Alpha and the and those are just really nice representations of like the Melon terroir, Alpha being the elegance and Melon being the power of it. But we made the varietals really just kind of for the enthusiasts of those. It's a recognizable name. You can say, oh, I love Cab Sauv. You have Cab Sauv? Yes, we do. Because, you know, a lot of our blends are Cab Sauv heavy anyway. But it's to the point of like we wanted to capture that varietal and, you know, like 100% essence and let people experience that alone. Then taste everything as we kind of build it together. At the end of the day, yeah, we really do make like 2 wines. It's like off and on is our main thing. And if we have a nice year for Cab, we'll make Cab, same with Merlot. But
But talk to us some about the winemaking approach and the different, I know you use concrete in addition to stainless steel, the barrel program. Talk to us about some of that.
Yeah, Katie, you want to?
Sure. So we use concrete for our Sauvignon Blanc. 2020 was our first vintage of Sauvignon Blanc.
So
we were actually able to incorporate that in with our Merlot because we didn't want the oak to overpower the fruit on our Merlot, because our Merlot is a pretty delicate wine.
Which I guess is like also, it's all new French oak barrels every year, so that's also like kind of the point of like she was talking about the Merlot maybe being over oak. I was just throwing in a little disclaimer of like why that would be just for the audience.
So for our fermentations, we do stainless steel fermentations on our reds as well as oak fermentation. And to talk you through a little bit of that, everything from harvest, everything is hand sorted in the vineyard and then picked into lugs, which are only 40-pound containers. So we want to be as delicate on the fruit as possible. And then once it gets into the winery, then we are hand sorting clusters for any underripe fruit or any leaves make it in onto the sorting table.
Leaves or bugs or what else you'll find in the vineyard.
Oh, with the 40 pounds, it's a little bit easier than, like, you know, like a half ton.
Yeah, yeah. And like Katie was saying, it's all about like managing that small quantity at a time. And it's we're built for accuracy, not speed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so cluster sorting.
We have an oscillating destemmer. So really delicate on the fruit. It just shakes off all the ripe berries onto our berry sorting table, which has grates in it, so if any shot berries get through there, then it doesn't go into our tanks to impact any green flavors into our fermentation. But all elevator into our fermentations.
Yeah, so we're, I guess, to explain what the elevator is, since we're not on video. So the elevator
push a button and then it rides up to the next.
Pretty much, yeah. So it's like gravity in essence, but we are using electric motors to move the fruit. But it's not going through like an auger and a muscle pump. So everything's kind of almost like little hands carrying it through the simmer. And then after it goes through the simmer, you're going to have your little hands carrying it through your fermenter. So everything, it's super gentle. It's the same amount of aggressiveness as like I was saying, like literally using your own hands to move it. It's just all machines. We're not a like gravity built winery, and there might be room for that in the future. We're kind of in a temporary phase right now where like the winery itself is not our final form, if that makes sense. And we might get gravity in the future where like your crush pad is going to be on a higher level and you're going to start moving things down without the assist of electric motors and going on step to step. So you might have like three levels.
Sounds like you have plenty of elevation to work with it.
Yes. Exactly.
We have to start digging, I guess.
Yeah.
Or have a shovel.
Hanging out over the edge, right?
Yeah. And it's it's a really great setup. And again, it kind of I keep saying Opus One. It kind of stems from that too. Like look at what they're doing and look at what Record Vintage Virginia is doing. And it's almost like it's hard for the East Coast because of the weather, but you can't look at the West Coast and think you can make a wine close to that quality. You have to actually like spend more money and spend it wisely. Like what is going to directly impact my wine quality? And not so much of like we're not wasting money on flair. It's more of like this is very functional, operational. It's not like a beautiful winery, like on the inside, but on the outside it is got really nice rock work. But it's a functional space and it's like a kitchen. Whereas all the equipment is there to increase the quality of.
We're looking at as much complexity as possible every step of the way. From the blocks that we select to harvest at certain times to choosing what fermentation vessel they're going into, to what yeast strain we're using, to separating our pre-run from our fresh run fractions, to what toast levels the wine is going to, what barrel it's going into.
Yeah, we departmentalize everything. We break it down into its all the smallest forms. And you're making Cabernet Sauvignon 10 different ways. And that's kind of the cool thing about like stainless steel, and you have your old school 40 hectoliter oak French oak fermenters. You get Europe, and you have Napa on like each side of the winery, and you have a really cool contrast of blending both of those styles together to really make a more complex. And then using some of the concrete, like you're mentioning, like with the Merlot, which I thought that was a pretty smart angle. It's like if you don't want to over oak your wine, well, concrete's essentially an oak barrel. It breathes. It's porous. It's just not imparting any flavors onto it. Hmm. So you can really focus your terroir expression, focus your varietal expression of that one grape using that vessel. Then we did finish it in 600 liter. So that's what, you know, we're evolving as we're doing this and figuring this out. So most of our wines are standard 225 liter new French oak barrels. But we did have some custom built 600 liters for Merlot in particular. This would be a slower extraction, and we don't have to like hustle between different vessels so much. Just kind of looking at a balance standpoint. We don't want to coat a beautiful steak with a very rich sauce on the steak.
Great analogy. So you mentioned a little bit about some temporary setup or where it's not permanent. Mm-hmm. So maybe talk about what are some of the things that you hope to do in the future on the estate?
Yeah. You want me to do the winery? You want to do the winery? Because there's a winery aspect and then there's a customer aspect too. So like, I guess, as you guys know, the winery is not attached to the tasting lounge currently. And of course, people are always curious about, you know, where's the winery? Well, it's, you know, 45 seconds up the hill there, but they don't see it. And I think, you know, looking at that property and like where we could put things is, I guess, part of the challenge as far as all the spots are really nice.
Yeah.
But we kind of want to put some stuff on higher elevation. Like going back to talking like gravity fed wineries, a bit more of a nice vista, like a nice view over the tree line for the customers. And when we started it, that was kind of like our investor was saying, you need to use like kind of what you have. I'll get you the equipment, but like this building's here to use that. This building's here, let's use that. Save money where you can and spend it where it really matters, which is your wine. But as you grow your brand and start bringing some revenue, you can start looking at where you expand. And we're not going to expand in the quantity of wine, but we're going to expand in like the quality of customers.
I mean, so well, what we're looking at longer term will be to like the higher elevation. We might be looking at doing almost a winery tasting experience that is higher elevation. When you're at our tasting lodge currently, as you're looking out to the left, there's a really nice spot that on the highest point of that vineyard, you can look out and you can see towards Winston-Salem.
Yeah, right there. You can see downtown Winston-Salem.
Like you can see the skyline right there. I feel like looking towards the future, that's kind of something people are kind of missing.
Yeah, well, whatever we can do to improve the experience is what we're looking at. Like I said, first and foremost, when we started the business plan, the entire goal was like, we're going to make good wine. Wine first, flair later, which is very important. And of course, like what we have now is beautiful. Like
it's
a lovely space. And we're just always looking at how we can evolve and like how we can elevate it. Using the word elevation like a lot here, but that's kind of the theme. That's the theme of the property. That's the theme of the brand. It's just like everything besides the physical, where you are standing on planet Earth, to your actual experience and what your mood should be like. How you feel about time you leave.
Nice. Well, it's cool that you mentioned too, like actually trying to get a little bit higher. It's hard to imagine that.
Right.
There's still room to go up.
So yeah, awesome. Yeah. Because you're kind of nestled like right between vineyards and stuff. And it's funny because like a lot of wineries are looking at, you know, mountaintops and mountain ranges in the distance. You're on a mountain here. So you have to really, I mean, this new tasting facility, you know, we probably put it on stilts. Like we're really going to put it on the highest, you know, elevation on the site locally, and then probably, raise it up from there and see if we can put a winery into that to where it's the highest point would be like the crush pad. And like I said, we're going to flow wine down probably, you know, 3 to 4 different levels and have people be able to kind of interact with that and see that. Because I think that's a big part of the experience. The transparency is very important. And, like I said, people are always like, where's the winery? And it is very close, but if they can actually kind of have something a little more tangible, I think that would make everybody happy.
Well, then you almost have like one of those show kitchens, right? So you have to make sure everything's clean and tidy. Not that it isn't, but
right.
You know,
yes.
Everyone's
yeah.
looking at you, judging you now.
Right, so right. Well, okay. And we'll put the window in. I've worked on it in the past. I had the window. There's like Krispy Kreme pretty much.
Oh, yeah.
Just a bunch of angry people in the cellar staring up at, you know.
So what's the equivalent of the hot mouth sign in a winery?
Oh, man, what is that? When you open that barrel open, do a cellar tasting. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you've all been working together for quite some time now.
Yeah.
What would you say has left the biggest impact on you over the years?
Well, I think besides just like growing as a team together and even expanding that team to like really nice people like Jenny and Joseph Geller, like kind of working with people that we have like an immense mutual respect for. Like, I've learned a lot from Katie, for example. And like when you work with somebody that you share the same goal, but you have a different way of achieving that goal, instead of me being upset that somebody has a different viewpoint, you accept it and you learn from it. And it's vice versa. And it's always been the pinnacle of my career, and it's been great for me. And loving who you work with is amazing. And I think everybody that, you know, it's a lot of synergy, and we're all happy with each other. That's the main point. People really do make the product, and if you don't believe in that, it's going to be really hard to do.
I think we couldn't do this without each other, but also where we are, what we're able to achieve, premium wine production, really just working together, knowing the site selection that we have, what we're able to achieve, really.
Yeah, it helps when everybody's on the same page and everybody mm-hmm. believes in what they're doing, and that's part of the authenticity. We're not trying to sell the gimmick. We believe in this.
The passion behind it,
yeah. From Emma Winery to out in the vineyard to the sales front, I couldn't ask to work with any better people.
Awesome.
It certainly does make the days go by much more easily, and makes coming to work and
for sure
much more exciting.
It's really not a job. Yeah. That's the other thing too.
Yeah.
Like once you stop looking at it as a job, it's really not. Yeah, this is like, you know, our
it's a passion.
Project. Yeah,
it's a passion.
And
every day is different.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
What would you say you're looking forward to as like the next big thing?
Well, I guess besides a lot of things that we just covered, probably like some of the wines and getting creative with what we can offer our customers, not just from a drink standpoint, but like I was saying, from experiences and getting some feedback. So we're not even 1 year open at this point, but now we're kind of looking at what do people like, what do they don't like, and we're all open-minded. Of course, you can't make everybody happy, but we have over 100 wine club members, which is really nice. I've kind of boosted up in a short period of time. I think, yeah, for the future, besides, like, again, so you'll talk about like rosé and sparkling wine, like,
I guess we
landed on that.
Please.
Yeah. I guess we kind of talked about rosé a little bit. We really started, I guess it was June.
Yeah,
this year
it was, yeah.
And we had planned on opening the previous fall. So we had, you know, one white wine, four red wines to offer everyone. When we opened during the heat of the summer, we were really opening a lot of Sauvignon Blanc, of course.
Yeah.
It's hot outside, mm-hmm. somebody wants something cold to drink and refreshing, high acid, lower alcohol. So the rosé really
made sense.
We felt like was missing with our program.
We never planned on it originally.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, we barely planned on a white wine, but we figured we have it planted. If it's, might as well do it. So, but rosé just fell in naturally as we looked at people, grabbing for the colder drinks, which is, I mean, it's us too. What's better than like a very ice cold rosé on a hot day?
Absolutely. I would say a sparkling, which you also mentioned.
There you go. Yeah. Yes. I forgot about that. Yeah, you were talking about that too.
Yes. So we can both talk about that. But so we already have Chardonnay planted on the property. So we've kind of started Chardonnay. We made a Chardonnay sparkling base this year.
Nice.
And so we're kind of working on building up a cuvée with that. We may release a vintage Chardonnay. Sparkling traditional method, maybe in a few years.
Yeah, that's figuring out like the style of sparkling. Of course, it's all going to be champagne method, But as far as like how long you want it to be on the lees, is it going to be, you know, you're not copying Dom Perignon, but the style, the richness, the brioche. But actually, like, I think we both kind of changed our viewpoint on champagne as a concept and like what it is. And I mean, some of our favorite wines ever were like Grand Cru Chablis, complex, but high acid, lively and vibrant. And sometimes you miss that with some champagnes that are like 10 years on the lees, and it's more of like a cooked apple, almost like, you know, very, very easy brioche-y. And that's nice, but we took a lot of inspiration from, we started drinking a lot of Domaine Guibras, Tethys Vineyard in particular, it's Grand Cru champagne. And I like the way that it was described by a wine importer in Australia, where he was talking about how lovely and elegant and red champagnes can be. Where a lot of times it's referred to, it's a sword wrapped in silk. To where it's high acid, it's very elegant. But he said, Domaine Guibras is a sword stuck in an electrical outlet. And you're going to get that by having, you know, less time on these. Like, instead of like aging your cuvées for 10 years, I think honestly, less might be more. People want it too, because everyone's just like,
oh yeah,
hey, when's this wine coming out? I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, It could be a decade. I don't know. But yeah. So we're going to do a combination. So we want to release a lot of like really fresh, sparkling wines. Still, we're talking at least, you know, 2 years minimum on these. But hold that back to, we want a 5 year on. Like, we're talking about sparkling wine off recording a little bit about like second disgorgement. So just like do the same wine, hold it for another 5 years, disgorge it again, see what that's like.
Yeah.
As much variation as we can, and no pun intended, but like we've uncorked a monster. Once you start this process, you're very well invested into it for a long period of time.
Yeah. And, there's no quick sparkling wine.
There's no quick sparkling wine. No, there's
not traditional.
Yeah,
not
traditional.
Yeah. Doing it right, but really capturing that style, I think, is really important. And I've had a hard time finding really good Chablis lately. Climate change included on that. Mm-hmm. But that's why we started looking at these champagnes.
He does. Absolutely. So you mentioned climate change a little bit. So how is that impacting decisions you're making in the vineyard and the winery?
It's definitely something I think that being in the wine industry, like, you notice because you're dealing with fruit. But as far as like this year, for example, was almost like an unknown. There seems to be a pattern right now. Bad year, good year. Like 19, for example, was awesome. 2020 was one of the worst things we've ever seen. Where it was hurricane after hurricane, rain event after rain event. 21 was awesome. And 22 was kind of in between. We dodged hurricane. That was our only threat for the season. It was a lot of early season rain, honestly, but a lot of our reds are late. But what's kind of saved us?
Yeah, like, well, usually I think a lot of North Carolina vineyard owners are worried about planting late season ripening varietals, such as Cab Sauv.
Right.
But that at that stage where we were and where Hurricane Ian was, like, it wasn't ripe enough to where it was going to cause any damage from rain. We probably maybe got about an inch and a half of rain from that, but it was mainly wind. So we felt like we needed to hedge our bets with that. And really, with the styles of wines we're making, we have to feel like make some risks. In order to get the rewards that we're hoping for. So,
like wine making in general, it seems.
Yeah, we kind of flipped it this year as far as we picked Petit Verdot, not too early, but like earlier than maybe we would want. But of course, that's a vineyard manager versus us. And, that was our insurance policy of this wine is going to be clean. I mean, it was still over 24 bricks, so we're not like too upset about it. But on this site, like, we've gotten 28 bricks in the past for Petit Verdot. Yeah, we're looking 24, 25 bricks.
That's us being picky.
Yeah, we thought about that too. We're like, you know, years ago, whenever you like pass on your career and like other places you've worked, and you kind of, you know, a lot of people will be thankful for even 22 bricks. People will just say, oh yeah. And, It was us being picky. But having that insurance pick of like a nice portion of Petit Verdot, it's not a 16% alcohol blender this year, but it can at least, you know, if we were wrong about the hurricane and cab came kind of shaky and light, we'd have something nice and clean to blend with would not be the same price point that we're currently selling. That's another thing. We do plan to, you know, if the year is not as good, we're not going to charge you for it. We'll take that on to ourselves. And and so we'll fluctuate in both directions, honestly.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it should. Like, it's like a lot of people pick a price point, and it's like we make caps off, and it's $35 every year. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at the rest of the world, it's they fluctuate.
Yeah.
So we plan to do the same thing. I mean, yeah, new wines actually, besides sparkling and rosé, barrel sauv blancs, concrete sauv blancs, we have like a non-vintage blend coming out. We talk about 2020 being terrible. We're not selling $100 2020 to anybody, but we did have some wins from that year for sure. We made a lot less wine, but what we made was nice. But yeah, doing like a non-vintage blend, and we're gonna price it. You know, we're looking at doing some sub $40 price points for some wines and some wine club exclusives. Also, again, RDV, Record of Ink, these guys.
Yeah,
they really. We noticed they have a friends and family with wine club and making wines, but we don't see any harm in kind of doing almost like an overture or friends and family, or like, you know, almost like a secondary brand.
Yeah, sure.
We want as many people as humanly possible to experience. Yeah, we're skeptical. Weird, you know. Very expensive, but once you leave, they buy wine. They buy the most expensive wine, and they said their time is worth it. And that's what we, you know, Jenny always says the same thing too. You know, the main takeaway is people leave happy, even if they don't buy anything. They enjoy themselves, they enjoy their time, and they don't feel like their money was wasted.
Well, it's like an escape to another world, though. Like you, as you're climbing the mountain, you're entering into another, an oasis of sorts,
yes.
And you're. To me, you mentioned the state park or national forest or something earlier. I always think of it, it's almost like being on the parkway, and the lodge is kind of reminds me of some of the buildings that you might see on the parkway.
Yeah, for sure.
So that to me it's just, there's a different feeling that you have as you're climbing up and seeing all the orchards and the vineyards and getting to the tasting lodge. It's just a really cool experience.
Definitely. So tell our listeners how they can find you.
Well, so besides, you know, dynamistestatewines.com.
Physical, if you're coming to see us for right off 77, exit 79.
Yeah, I think it's 79, Jonesville, North Carolina.
In Jonesville. And pretty much right after you take that exit, you're driving up to our property. We do try to do reservation only, but we don't want to turn anybody away.
Yeah, we want you to experience it any way possible. If you show up, don't be afraid. Ring the gate, and I'm sure we can do something for you, even if it's short notice. But your best experience would be, of course, making that reservation. So we make sure there's enough space for everybody. We're well staffed for everybody. We want everyone to have an A-plus experience.
Yes, we want to take our time with everybody and all have a good time.
Awesome. Well, Matt and Katie, thank you very much. We've definitely had a good time with this conversation. We're looking forward to our next experience and visit there. So.
Absolutely, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Cork Talk.
Thanks again to Matt and Katie. It was great to see a younger generation of winemakers who have a passion and drive to make the best wine possible.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. It helps others find Cork Talk and lets us know how we can improve.
And don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at NC Wine Guys. Until next time, and remember, the cork only talks when it's out of the bottle. Cheers!
Cork Talk is a Free Run LLC production.
This episode was made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council.